Hi everyone, I'm Josh, and this is The Emerald, Currents and Trends Through a Mythic Lens, the podcast where we explore an ever-changing world and our lives in it through the lens of myth, story, and imagination. The Emerald, all that's happening on this green jewel in space. So I want to start today by reading a part of a wonderful interview that David Marchese of the New York Times Magazine had with Late Show host Stephen Colbert, who happens to be both my favorite news source and my favorite fellow Tolkien nerd. Colbert is also a practicing Catholic, kind of an anomaly in the liberal entertainment world. And Marchese had the courage to ask him very sincerely about faith and how it fits into the liberal worldview and into modern 21st century politics. So Marchese says, "I want to ask you what's probably a naive question about faith, but I promise that it's sincere, and it's about something I'm hoping you can help me with. This is related to the idea of how belief in nationalism is ultimately about the feeling and comfort that idea gives people, and maybe not so much about objective facts, which is to say it's about a kind of faith. But, and I think this is part of what I've always stumbled over with religion, why is it that we might accept a form of belief that perhaps doesn't jive with objective reality as being fundamentally problematic and socially detrimental, while another one, religious belief, we're supposed to understand as okay? Can parallels be drawn there?" And here's Colbert's response. "That's interesting. That's a really big question. I think you're describing two different things. Everyone approaches their own faith in their own way, so you might be describing an exact parallel between someone's faith and our present political moment. There might be no difference to some people. To me, there's a difference because in the red meat that gets thrown out in many political rallies, not just this president's, you're indulging the audience's appetite. That's not the same thing as appealing to their principles. To indulge the audience's appetite is what my old character on the Colbert Report used to do. That was indulging a white, Christian, straight, male, American, hegemonic self-image, and that's not the same thing as faith. Faith is an acceptance of reality for me, and it is an attempt to humbly perceive what your role is. And my faith, as anemic as it is, reminds me of values of fellowship, love, humility. Those are all things that I might have in common with people at anyone's red meat slinging rally. But when the meat is offered at those rallies, maybe the principles aren't as important as the meat. Faith is different. Faith is not trying to change the world. Faith is not trying to change God. Faith isn't trying to change the order of things. Faith isn't trying to maintain your position. Faith isn't trying to make less of the other. Faith is asking God to change you. You are the subject of God's love. And in accepting that, you can transform yourself and release yourself of these appetites that are almost always at someone else's expense. That's how they're different to me." Of course, Colbert's answer gets at a key point. Depends on what you believe in. If you believe in love, and in a great cosmic love driving the engine of reality, and that our task as humans is to align to this love however we can, in our respect for nature and for each other, even though science might have no objective evidence that love is anything other than neurons firing in the human brain and it may not matter one way or the other, then probably most would agree that that type of belief is a good thing, even if they don't believe that it necessarily, as Marchese says, jibes with objective reality. Of course, that type of belief is not always exemplified by the practitioners of institutionalized religion, and since belief also gets associated with a lot of difficult-to-swallow alternative facts, like the ridiculous notion of the earth being 6,000 years old or what have you, it's easy to see how people might conclude that belief of any kind lies firmly in the realm of the irrational and is distanced from objective reality. Which makes this statement right at the heart of Colbert's response so intriguing. Faith is an acceptance of reality. So I want to discuss this a little more. and because there are few things as polarized in the Western world as the science-spirit divide, naturally some listeners are going to hear this and think, oh, he's taking the side of faith. And no, that's not what this is about. It's about taking a deeper look at our assumptions about, well, objective reality, to look at Western notions of objectivity and where we culturally buy into stories that we assume are the way it is and maybe aren't the way it is at all. And maybe to start to emulate the Japanese kintsugi potters and pour a tiny, tiny bit of gold into the massive fissure that exists between science and spirituality in the West. A divide, it should be noted, that does not exist everywhere and is so, so deep here we can't always see how it plays out in our minds and our lives. And just to be clear, listeners can be sure that when I talk about spiritual topics, I'm in no way defending the follies and horrors in acted by the major organized religions of the world. That's another topic entirely. I'm talking about the nature of reality and our understanding of the universe we live in, objectively speaking. So here we go. Who gets to claim objective reality? Today on The Emerald. Okay, so I want to start with the crux of Marchesi's question, which is a comparison of nationalism and faith, in that they both involved, as he puts it, a belief in something that may not jibe with objective reality. Now, I share his unstated criticism here of the post-fact world we live in, and the tendency of, let's say, certain political groups and certain news networks and certain religious groups with certain affiliations to ignore objective facts entirely. But there's also something implicit in his question that is worth exploring. Namely, there's an implication that there are other political parties or worldviews that are more in touch with objective reality. Presumably the Democratic Party or the non-Fox News media or the scientific community. And yes, within our current culture and its assumptions about the nature of objective reality, these institutions lie a whole lot less than their right-wing counterparts. But let's talk about this a little more. Let's talk about objective reality before one group claims it as their sole domain and property. The dominant global worldview right now is that of neoliberal capitalism, a vision of unfettered accumulation of stuff in which economies are expected to do nothing but grow, and everyone is supposedly entitled to a piece of the pie, and even though the gap between rich and poor seems to be reaching ridiculous proportions, if we just keep consuming and growing and consuming and growing, it's all going to work out great. Talk about a faith-based worldview that doesn't necessarily jibe with objective reality. Look at anything in nature and tell me how that works. The most fundamental observation of objective reality will tell you that if you have a planet with limited resources, you can't just keep growing and growing indefinitely. Anyone who puts forward a model of unlimited growth on a planet with limited resources may themselves be out of touch with objective reality. And no, the Democratic Party, while they may have come around to listening to certain environmental realities, are still drinking the late-stage capitalist Kool-Aid. They are centrally responsible for the neoliberal worldview. So in one sense, capitalism is a faith-based worldview. I can think of no larger leap of faith than basically saying, we're going to keep producing and consuming at the rate we've been producing and consuming, even though science now tells us the catastrophic effect this will have on the world's species and, ultimately, us. In the 1995 film 12 Monkeys, the mad and ginger ponytailed antagonist Dr. Peters has the following to say, "Surely there is very real and very convincing data that the planet cannot survive the excesses of the human race. Proliferation of atomic devices, the rape of the environment, the pollution of land, sea, and air. In this context, isn't it obvious that the alarmists represent the sane vision and that Homo sapiens' motto, "Let's go shopping," is the cry of the true lunatic. Yet atheists, agnostics, and believers alike heed that call of conspicuous consumption, even in the face of mounting global evidence that to do so is, to quote Dr. Peters, a lunatic cry. Point is, people across the modern capitalist, political, social, and religious spectrum are driven by a whole set of beliefs that many cultures for many thousands of years would probably deem insane and far more out of touch with objective reality than, say, the feeling that there is an ineffable life force or a higher consciousness that exists within nature that connects everything. Like, really, what's more out of touch with reality? The Lakota sense of Wakantanka, the great spirit, mother and father nature, mirrored around the world in hundreds of traditions, or, say, Walmart. We've built such a culture around belief that we don't even see it as belief. The belief, for example, that our own personal worth is based on how much we do and make. How it's okay to spend 80% of your waking life sitting in front of a screen. Or that it's fine for one person to crap on a golden toilet while a million children die of waterborne illness annually. Or that we can have an indoor ski resort in the middle of the Sahara Desert and somehow that's okay. Or that the richest man in India has a 400,000-square-foot house, while in the same city, 500,000 people live in cardboard boxes. Or that we put our faith in ephemeral digital zeros in our bank accounts, and then we bet those non-existent zeros on a speculative future that doesn't actually exist. And we think that this is going to do anything but eventually bottom out the way that all waves within nature do. Alanis Obomsawin, an Abenaki tribesperson, is credited with speaking this famous saying to an early conference on indigenous issues. Only when the last tree is cut, the last fish eaten, and the last stream poisoned, will we realize that we cannot eat money. That's what you call a pretty healthy dose of objective reality, and all parties might want to listen. So simply put, religious types and nationalists are not the only ones prone to ignore objective reality, and those whose worldview is based on Western science are not the only ones who can lay claim to it. The truth of the matter is that there are plenty of people on all sides of the spectrum who are out of touch with objective reality, and there are also plenty of people, over the course of the ages, religious ones included, who had a pretty good handle on it. Like the Buddha, for example, who said something to the effect of, "Oh, guess what? Stuff won't make you happy. Dos Equis won't make you the most interesting man in the world. And by the way, karma is real. If you want a living planetary example of the karma of our conspicuous lifestyles, look at climate change, cause and effect." The Buddhist religion emphasized objective and subjective explorations of consciousness to get to the heart of what actually brings human beings peace. This peace, the spiritual traditions of the Indian subcontinent have told us for thousands of years, ultimately comes from within oneself, rather than through any particular set of external circumstances. It isn't the new job, or the new car, or the golden toilet, or whatever the 5,000 ads the average person is exposed to in a day are selling, that ultimately does it. It's your own heart. This is a pretty deep slice of objective reality, all from within religious tradition. And it was specifically within these traditions that the concept of ecological stewardship, kindness to fellow human beings, sharing of meals, and the living of a simple lifestyle in honor of nature first arose, principles which also call to mind Jesus' basic teaching on interconnectedness, that loving the other including the earth and her creatures, as we love ourselves, is the absolute key for beings who share an interconnected world. I'm fairly sure that David Marchese might agree with a lot of what I've said so far. And I'm also fairly sure that when he talks about religious belief, he's talking about some of the more egregious examples of religious nonsense we have today, and some of the more ridiculous things that these religions believe, which of course should be called out and questioned. What I'm offering is simply a step back from our own culture en masse, to say that we ourselves have blind faith in and believe in some things that most cultures in the world historically would not have associated with objective reality. Why do we do this? Because ultimately we think we're the only ones who know what objective reality is. And this has everything to do with Western science's claim on reality. Post-Enlightenment Western science, which arose challenging the more egregious and harmful beliefs of institutionalized Catholicism, has basically now come to claim that it has the one and only methodology to get to objective reality. And anyone who bases their worldview in anything but that methodology, which has been in play for precisely 0.1% of human history, is wrong. In this way, as environmental visionary Charles Eisenstein says, Western science acts a whole lot like Orthodox religion. This is the point in the podcast where everyone's going to get all "he hates science." Not at all. I benefit from modern Western science about 100 ways a day. What I am interested in looking at is any worldview that assumes that it is the only possible valid way of seeing reality. What I'm interested in asking is, are we really so sure? Can we really claim this to be the only valid paradigm through which to view the world? And if this paradigm is based on objectivity, can we really claim to be objective? And even if we can, is objectivity in all cases the best way to see things? Many consider Western science to sit on an unassailable throne of objectivity. The fact is that in every era that science has claimed objectivity, we can now look back and see a glaring lack of objectivity. Nowhere is this more evident than in colonial anthropology. Colonial anthropologists, for example, who seriously debated for decades on whether Australian Aboriginals were actually human, or who concluded the San people of southern Africa were too dumb to have any meaningful worldview, or too primitive to create the rock art that surrounded them. And then once it was finally acknowledged that they created the art, for decades no Western scientists thought it of value to actually interview them about what it meant, and so they just drew their own conclusions about what it meant, just as they did with indigenous rituals which they had never themselves experienced. And here's the thing. In each of these cases, they were absolutely convinced that they were acting with pure objectivity. So is clinical observation in a deliberately deanimated world really the best way to determine if there is or is not an animate force that inhabits the world? If the entire starting premise of the post-Enlightenment worldview is that matter is deanimated, are its adherents even capable of objectivity when it comes to the topic of spirit? For hundreds of thousands of years, hunter-gatherers around the world, and for the record, that's 99% of our ancestors for 99% of our history, have come to astonishingly similar conclusions about the nature of reality. These are people with the exact same brains as modern Westerners. All of these cultures, we can surmise from the thousands of living examples across the globe, and from the art and tradition left us, spoke of spirit, the breath of life, divine nature, cosmic energy that moves through all things, uniting us all, energy that is accessed through meditation, through trance, trance that is accessed through song or dance or direct spiritual revelation, prayer, simple surrender to the power of the universe. Knud Rasmussen, the famous Arctic explorer, asked an Inuit named Najagnik about if he believed in a higher power. Yes, a power that we call Sila, one that cannot be explained in so many words, a strong spirit, the upholder of the universe, of the weather, in fact, all life on earth, so mighty that his speech to man comes not through ordinary words, but through storms, snowfall, rain showers, the tempests of the sea, through all the forces that man fears, or through sunshine, calm seas, or small, innocent, playing children who understand nothing. When times are good, Sila has nothing to say to mankind. He has disappeared into his infinite nothingness and remains away as long as people do not abuse life, but have respect for their daily food. No one has ever seen Sila. His place of sojourn is so mysterious that he is with us and infinitely far away at the same time. That this animate force of nature would appear in its fierce form when people abuse life and lose respect for their daily food is a very simple and effective description of an objective reality that all of us can, perhaps, feel, no matter what framework of science or spirit we use to describe it. So let's go full circle and take it back to Colbert's central statement, in which he says, "Faith for me is an acceptance of reality." One of the things that is interesting about spiritual traditions that exist outside of the Western science-spirit split is that they don't really talk about faith or belief as if it's a particular mindset that you have to get yourself into in order to convince yourself there's something out there that you can't see or feel, because they actually see it and feel it. You're not going to go up to a San tribesman trembling after 24 hours of dancing, eyes wide in a state of divine revelation, and say, "Hey, do you actually believe what you're experiencing is objectively real? Do you have faith that the energy that just rose up so intensely that it knocked several of your fellow dancers over actually exists?" Because for peoples that exist outside of the Western science spirit split, there's not the same question of belief or really the necessity of a line between subjective and objective. The consciousness that drives nature is something that can be directly felt. It is felt in the state of trance or revelation that has been the essential driving quality of spiritual experience for 350,000 years. All shamanic traditions are built around it, this state that is precisely the merging of the subjective and the objective. So to try to measure it purely objectively, or to say that it doesn't exist because you can't, is a ruined experiment from day one. Let's put it this way. It is a very recent and localized view that contact with the divine is somehow intangible or requires a leap of faith or belief. It arose specifically because Western science put forward, for good reason at the time, that subjective experience might taint the experiment. So it deliberately removed the subject from the experiment, and in doing so made divine experience intangible. This extraction of the subject into the role of observer is supposed to be good science. In the case of spiritual experience, it's exactly why Western scientists aren't qualified to run the experiment. Objectivity is great in some cases. When it comes to an experience that ultimately must be subjective, that must be felt in the heart, experienced in a rush of exhilaration, or in a deep calming, or in a jolting awake, or in a settling of waves, or in a churning of oceans, or a dripping of nectar, or a buzzing and thrumming of the skull, or as a scintillating feeling of love rising, rising, rising upwards into vaults too beautiful to describe, objectivity has very little to offer. Let's take that in along with a quote from Claude Lévi-Strauss. "Against the theoretician, the observer should always have the last word. And against the observer, the native." So here's a scientist basically saying that ultimately the people themselves know what they're talking about, or at least there comes a point where you have to defer to native understanding of a particular subject. Science is slowly, slowly coming around to deferring to native cultures. The newfound scientific emphasis on ecology is wonderful, but it's also new. For centuries, science was used to empower and justify environmental degradation and the racist subjugation of the other. Scientists made doomsday devices and did atomic experiments on Polynesian tribes and scoffed at the notion that the planet was one living organism. Science now recognizes the value of time spent in nature, in forest immersion, in sitting around a fire, in meditation. There was a great article in the Smithsonian recently entitled, "Why Scientists Are Starting to Care About Cultures That Talk to Whales." It tells the story of an indigenous elder, Harry Brower Sr., who traveled in a dream to a whale hunt that his people were engaged in, and he saw who made the kill, precisely how the harpoon entered the whale, and the fact that the whale was a calving mother. Turned out that everything Brower saw in his dream was accurate, and the revelation caused him to hand down new rules on how to conduct the hunt in a way that honored the old traditions and preserves the whale population. From the article, "Not long ago, non-Indigenous scientists might have dismissed Brower's experience as a dream or the incoherent ramblings of a sick man. But he and other Inupiat are part of a deep history of Arctic and subarctic peoples who believe humans and whales can talk and share a reciprocal relationship that goes far beyond that of predator and prey. Today, as Western scientists try to better understand Indigenous peoples' relationships with animals, as well as animals' own capacity for thoughts and feelings, such beliefs are gaining wider recognition. If you start looking at the relationship between humans and animals from the perspective that Indigenous people themselves may have had, it reveals a rich new universe," says Matthew Betts, an archaeologist with the Canadian Museum of History who studies Paleo-Eskimo cultures in the Canadian Arctic. What a beautiful way to view the world. A beautiful way to view the world. Finally, science is listening, and this is a wonderful thing. Yet, in its new valuing of Indigenous wisdom, science still tends to stop short of the whole spirit thing. Indigenous peoples might be great knowers of plants or animals, for instance, worth studying in that regard. But the tendency is still to ignore the whole orientation towards spirit that, guess what, all of these cultures have. Well, science also is coming to know that things are studied best in their whole context. And the fact is that you may not be able to separate out the knowledge systems of Indigenous cultures from their connection to spirit. The very knowledge of those plants that modern science now sees as precious, for example, may have come in part from direct spiritual revelation. Ask the people themselves, and many will say it does. They will speak, some of them, of hearing the voices of the plants singing. What does science do with that? They doubt it until they feel it for themselves. The voices of the plants singing. David Foster Wallace, in his famously awesome commencement speech at Kenyon, tells the story of a fish swimming along, and he bumps into two other fish. "How's the water?" the fish asks the two other fish, who simply smile and nod and then swim away. When they're safely out of earshot, one fish turns to the other fish and says, "What's water?" It could very well be that, like the water in the story, there are things that human beings will never be able to measure objectively because we're so immersed in them. That there are forces so fine, so vast, so deep, that guide the movements of our world that are beyond measurement. So eventually, the journey for all of us is simply perhaps to recognize the water as the wonder it is. Wonder is a place where science and spiritual tradition share a lot of common ground. The wonder that a biologist may feel while observing the smallest function of a cellular process, or that an astrophysicist might experience when a black hole is photographed for the first time, is a concurrent feeling to that which people have in states of spiritual revelation. Almost all the great scientists speak of wonder. These same scientists, incidentally, question whether it is ultimately possible to even do an objective experiment, if objectivity even exists in the universe. This wonder is a feeling of revelation in the beauty and intricacy of creation, and a sense that no matter how much we know about how it all works, the why of it, the core of it, is a mystery, which gets at the heart of our discussion today. Objective reality is a mystery. So yes, faith is an acceptance of what is, and what is a mystery. What is, science and spiritual tradition undeniably agree, is our interconnectedness. What is, are the forces that move this universe that are still wondrous mysteries. What is the fact that love multiplies from heart to heart. What is that when I give of myself, I feel more full. What is that love always remains an option. I think we can all have a little more faith in that. This episode contains references to several movies, books, and articles. Stephen Colbert on the Political Targets of Satire by David Marchese, New York Times Magazine, May 31, 2019. The film 12 Monkeys. Joseph Campbell's Masks of God series. A Cosmos in Stone by David Lewis Williams. Why Scientists Are Starting to Care About Cultures That Talk to Whales, Krista Langlois. Smithsonian Magazine, April 6, 2018. If you liked what you heard today, please consider becoming a patron. You can find out more at patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. That's Patreon, patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. There are patronage levels starting for as low as $6 per month. And patrons get a variety of benefits that are listed on the site. I hope you enjoy today's episode, and until next time, may we live lives that are driven forth by imagination, vision, and wonder.